I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In Israel, a two-month lull in terrorist attacks has ended. Today, a suicide bomber blew up a bus in the northern city of Haifa, killing at least 15 and injuring dozens. Many of the casualties are thought to be college students from the nearby University of Haifa. Joining us from Jerusalem is Ben Linfield, who writes for the Christian Science Monitor. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
Ben, no terror attack in Israel since January 5th, when two suicide bombers killed 23 in Tel Aviv. Why this attack? Why now?
Well, the Israeli government and security services would say that the Palestinians are trying all the time to make attacks, and that the reason there was a lull and no successful attacks was because of the success of the security forces in foiling attacks. And they would also attribute it to what they call a very aggressive Israeli policy in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. In recent weeks, especially in Gaza, Israel has been doing daily raids into Palestinian areas. A very large number of civilians have been killed in these attacks.
Some Israelis, in fact, near Gaza feel vulnerable, do they not, to rocket attacks from Gaza, which some of these Israelis blame on the Israeli offensive in Gaza? Yeah,
Bill, that's true. Israelis in the town of Sderot are very concerned about the rocket attacks, but it needs to be stressed that there were no rockets for 3 weeks going on to Sderot from the Gaza Strip. Ever since the Palestinian police had put its police in the border area. That ended, the quiet ended, when Israel did an incursion into Gaza City and in the process killed four of the Palestinian police who were guarding against the attacks. Hamas then responded with attacks, and every time there's been an Israeli incursion into Gaza, there have afterwards been attacks by Hamas with what they call a Qassam rocket. It's important to note, because these kind of terrorist attacks are so egregious and horrible, they grab all the headlines, but there has also been a daily attrition and killing of Palestinian civilians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. During the month of February, no Israeli civilians were killed inside Israel. 72 Palestinians were killed, many or most of them civilians.
Was this offensive, though, not ignited by an attack by Islamic guerrillas, presumably against an Israeli tank, killing a number of Israeli soldiers a couple of weeks ago?
Yes, that was an attack on a tank that killed four people, and Israel proceeded to make almost daily incursions that killed dozens of Palestinians. So that's way beyond what in military terms would be a response to the tank.
Ben, is there any light at the end of the tunnel of Mideast peace, peace between Israelis and Palestinians?
No light whatsoever until the Bush administration gets seriously involved in solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and brings serious pressure to bear on both sides.
Ben Linfield, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ben Linfield of the Christian Science Monitor joined us from Jerusalem.
Yesterday, the BBC aired an interview with U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, one of the few the secretary has given to the foreign press. Several exchanges became testy. Here, the BBC's David Dimbleby asked Secretary Rumsfeld whether Rumsfeld believed U.N. support for the U.S. position on Iraq would have been stronger if the administration had worked harder for peace between Israel and the Palestinians.
That is a problem that's a tough one. And it's been a tough one my entire adult lifetime. And that it has not been solved in the last 20 months ought not to be a surprise to anybody. The president cares about it. He is concerned about it. He has addressed it. And I think that had there been success there, there would have been probably greater support.
And yet America is seen as applying double standards in this, isn't it? I mean, using the UN against Iraq, for instance, and then you yourself saying, repeating two or three times in the context of Israel and the UN resolutions there, that the occupied territories on the West Bank are so-called occupied territories. That's the kind of thing that makes people think, well, actually, America's not serious about this. They're so pro-Israel.
Interesting.
They're not. Well, you said that.
Well, first of all, I did not repeat it two or three times. You're just factually wrong.
You said it twice in the same series of remarks. You used the expression so-called.
Fair enough. I was in a meeting, and I was asked a question, and the phrase came out.
But is what you think, that they're so-called occupied, or do you think they're occupied and should be given up?
I think that that's what a negotiation is going to solve. I mean, that is what the negotiation is about. Obviously, Israel is offered to give back a major portion of the occupied territories. We know that. The agreement was there. It could have been solved if Arafat had accepted it. He didn't.
The Secretary of Defense was also asked about possible war with Iraq. At one point, the BBC interviewer interrupted Rumsfeld as he outlined U.S. reasons for targeting Saddam Hussein.
The critical issue is the relationship between weapons of terror states, which Iraq is by everyone's agreement.
America took it off the list of terror states 20 years ago.
I don't know that.
When you visited Iraq and negotiated with Saddam Hussein, when America wanted Saddam Hussein for its own purposes, America took Iraq off the list of terrorist states and indeed supplied it with the wherewithal to make the chemical weapons they're now trying to remove.
Well, I've read that type of thing, but I don't know where you get your information, and I don't believe it's correct. They may have been taken off. I was a private businessman and was asked for a few months to assist after the 241 Marines were killed in Beirut, Lebanon. And I did meet with Saddam Hussein. I did not give him or sell him or bring him any chemical weapons or any biological weapons, as some of the European press likes to print. It's just factually not true. Now, whether or not the United States at some point, when I was not part of the government, decided to take him off a terrorist list, you may be right. In fact,
are you saying you don't know, you didn't know when you went there whether he was on the list of terror states or not? You were trying to reopen relationship between the United States and Iraq.
That's right. And I believe he was on the list of terror states when I went there.
We're being diverted a bit here, but let's just go into this, because it's another of the causes of a lack of credibility, or a credibility gap that you particularly have to fill, that you were there, met the man.
I was asked by the president and Secretary Shultz to meet with him and to see. That was one of the few Middle Eastern countries that had not reestablished relationships with the United States after the earlier Middle East war.
But you're not saying that you weren't aware that he was using chemical weapons, because the Secretary of State at the time had said they were using them.
I was certainly aware of that. I didn't say I wasn't aware of that. I said that I was not aware that the United States gave him, as you suggested, or I gave him, and that I had some burden to bear. That's just utter nonsense.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld speaking with BBC interviewer David Dimbleby in a rare interview with the foreign press. For more, go to our website, here-now.org.
An alleged cover-up with near-comic overtones. Three off-duty police officers allegedly beating people up for their takeout food has led to serious trauma in the San Francisco Police Department. 10 police officers, including the police chief, assistant chief, and 2 deputy chiefs, have pleaded not guilty to criminal charges ranging from conspiring to obstruct justice to felony assault. The case revolves around a rookie officer whose dad is the city's assistant police chief. Alex Fagan Jr. is accused of involvement in the takeout food assault and 16 other violent incidents over a 13-month period between 2001 and 2002. Joining us to discuss all this now is Jackson Vanderbecken, who's been covering the story for the San Francisco Chronicle. Hello, Mr. Vanderbecken.
Hello.
Mr. Vanderbecken, first, it's an uneasy time for a lot of Americans and for San Franciscans. There's always crime, but now we have terror alerts. How are average people feeling out there with a police department in turmoil?
Well, the people in San Francisco are just scratching their heads. I mean, many people have suspected things for a long time connected with this case, which started in November. And now, you know, the worst fears or some people's nightmares have come true, in the sense of people realizing that this cover-up, alleged or otherwise, may have extended all the way up to the chief of police. So it's disquieting. And also, I think a number of people thought that, you know, it was high time somebody be held account to this. But we'll see whether these charges really stick.
The officers pleaded not guilty yesterday. What happens now?
There's a fragment or a group of the 7 command staff officers who say they want a trial as soon as possible. And the patrol officers, including Alex Fagan Jr., want to step back and take a look at what evidence is really there and they're saying they don't want an immediate trial.
Hmm. Now, do all the charges swirl around Alex Fagan Jr. and his alleged history of violence and a cover-up of that alleged history of violence, or is there more to this?
Well, essentially, the charges revolve around the incident on November 20th. What had happened was is that Fagan Jr. Had been at a gathering on behalf of his father and had left that gathering with some friends, fellow officers, and had gone to at least one or more bars. They encountered two men who, one of them had a bag of beefsteak fajitas. And at that point, they are alleged to have accosted the men and demanded their food, triggering a dispute and ultimately an alleged beating. Then the question is, what happened after that? The sergeant, the lieutenant, a captain, and up the chain of command are all now accused of trying to thwart that investigation, spread misinformation, not allow documents to be reviewed by the proper authorities, etc.
Mr. Vanderbecken, right now the police force is being run with 10 replacement officers and a police chief named Heather Fong, who was barely known, certainly to the public, before just a little while ago. How are they doing, and what's morale like on the force?
Well, morale is a difficult quantity here. A lot of officers say they're with the chief, who is still in power, even though he's on medical leave. But the fact is that it has to be disquieting or demoralizing for the rank and file to see their police department, you know, racked with this kind of turmoil.
Hmm. Turbulent times in a great city. Jackson Vanderbecken, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jackson Vanderbecken is a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle.
And this note, some harsh insults have marked the third meeting of the emergency summit of Islamic nations in Qatar. Today, Iraq's vice president told a Kuwaiti diplomat to shut up, you monkey, and added, curse be upon your mustache. Well, the exchange came after a Kuwaiti suggestion that Saddam Hussein go into exile and reflects the rift on that issue. But it also got us wondering about the meaning of a mustache and a monkey. We asked Bernard Haeckel, assistant professor of Middle Eastern Studies and History at New York University, about the seriousness of the insults.
They're very serious. They're about as serious as you can get short of cursing someone's mother or sister. When the Iraqi was calling the Kuwaiti a monkey, he was basically saying, you know, you're a puppet of the U.S. You jump through hoops when your master tells you to do so. And the curse on the mustache is really a curse intended to insult one's honor, the honor of the Kuwaiti in this case.
Professor Bernard Haeckel of New York University. By the way, Professor Haeckel also said Saddam Hussein's repeated references to Iraqi honor in his recent interview with Dan Rather indicate the Iraqi president will not consider exile as an option.
Just ahead, Jarhead describes Marines in Gulf War I in battle. The author of the new book tells us how Marines really feel.
And later, the defense plans to put abortion itself on trial in the case of a man accused of killing a doctor.
There's more coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. The Bush administration's facing another roadblock in its efforts to use military force against Iraq. France, Russia, and Germany say they'll not allow a U.N. resolution authorizing war to pass. For more on the president's agenda and the soaring stakes, go to WBUR.org and click on News. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by ColorTech, photographic and digital processing services for the imaging consumer, at Campus Camera in Kenmore Square, 727 Atlantic Avenue, and 290 Main Street in Kendall Square. And Barrett Communications, building collaborative client relationships with a mission to deliver informed web, UI, collateral, and logo design solutions. In Kendall Square, Cambridge, and on the web at barrett.com, RRTT. And Schneider Leasing Company, providing short-term computer rental services for conferences, conventions, and special events. 617-261-6060. It's 21 minutes past 12.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Gung-ho, gripped by visions of glory, girls, and greasing the enemies of the United States of America, Anthony Swofford joined the U.S. Marines as soon as he legally could at the age of 17. In 1991, he went to war, the first Gulf War, where he nearly died from unfriendly fire, from friendly fire and inside a booby-trapped Iraqi bunker. Now he's written a fierce book about all this called Jarhead, which is what Marines are called and call themselves and what their heads and their tight haircuts kind of look like. Anthony Swafford joins us on the line. Hello, Anthony.
Hello, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Anthony, your book's the cover story of this past Sunday's New York Times Book Review, which is quite an accomplishment. And it says on that cover, quote, "Out of the 1991 war against Iraq comes Anthony Swafford, a Marine sniper, to say in his book that he had a ball," unquote. Did you have a ball?
No, I didn't, actually. Occasionally throughout my Marine Corps career, I did have a ball, and those moments are in the book, but it's a pained recollection and meditation of life in the Marine Corps and at war.
Anthony, paint me a picture of what it's like to be a soldier in the deserts in and around Iraq.
As evening falls, it's some of the training will be standing down, and it's you'll eat your meal, and it'll be kind of a quiet moment, and maybe a jocular moment where you're kidding around with someone, and it'll be pleasant. But as night falls, the desert changes, and it becomes a moodier and possibly a kind of more sinister space. And if you're really on the front lines right now, you're ready for an attack from missiles, and you're probably in a hole with someone in your team. You take turns sleeping. You listen to the kind of large, vast sounds of the night, and you spend a lot of time thinking about what exactly awaits you if someone comes your way or if you're sent to fight. And so you must always be kind of in tune with your fear, because if you let your fear guide you, you might also feel safe and through that fear feel a little more alive.
Marines trained so ferociously to be invulnerable, but these young men and women are vulnerable, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. They're, for the most part, 18 to 21 or 22 years old, incredibly vulnerable outside of communities and families that they knew for most of their lives. Very much together, but at the same time, in their units, but at the same time, alone and vulnerable.
Yet so much of your book is about a young man who wasn't fearless at all.
Right. It's part of the mythos of the military in general, and especially the Marine Corps. And, you go to sleep at night during boot camp or during other parts of training where the drill instructors are saying prayers about fighting whatever great menaces the United States might have in the future. But that doesn't mean that when you're digging a fighting hole that you're not afraid of what's coming. At the same time, you're probably most confident in your abilities, but that doesn't erase fear.
What keeps both sides in the fight, you say in another part of the book, pride, bravery, stupidity, and fear. You don't mention patriotism. Why?
Well, I think for the Marine, at least, the Marine Corps is really, in some ways, more important than the country, because the Marine Corps and your fellow Marines will keep you alive. Unfortunately, they might kill you as well. But where you sleep, where you eat, what you're part of is the Marine Corps before it's the country, and thus patriotism. Not to say that the armed services are void of patriots, but
there are no rewards, not on the field of battle. You say at one point in the book, not for the men who fight the battle. The rewards accrue in places like Washington, D.C., and Riyadh, and Houston, and Manhattan, south of 125th Street. What did you mean?
Well, the men who are fighting and dying, are not the people who get the payoff in the end. They suffer, they fight, they may die, watch their friends die, but they come home and there may be some ribbons and badges and a parade or two, but that's really it. That's the payoff.
How do you feel about the men who send young soldiers to war? In this case, an administration with virtually no members of it who have ever heard a shot fired in anger,
a Congress, both senators and congressmen, none of whom have any children in the armed forces. I think there may be one exception to that.
Mm-hmm.
They've been called chicken hawks in certain quarters. What do you think of the men who are sending young men and women to war this time?
Well, I think that they need to listen carefully to the citizens who are out here, the people who do have sons and daughters who are abroad and about to maybe fight. I think they really need to do a better job of convincing, especially the fathers and mothers of those people, that that there's something just about it. And I don't think they've done that work yet.
Anthony Swafford, would you recommend to a young man or woman contemplating enlisting in the Marines that they do it or not?
If it was someone close to me, the age of 18, came to me today asking that question, I would urge them not to.
Why?
Well, because I'd probably care for them and I want them to stay alive. And it's a rough and violent lifestyle, and it's a rough and violent way to live. And I don't, and they'll be changed forever by the experienced. And that doesn't make it necessarily a bad thing, but I've been there and lived it, and I'm not certain that it's for everyone.
Hmm. Anthony Swafford, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Bill.
Anthony Swafford is a former Marine sniper and author of the book Jarhead.
Tomorrow on Here Now, is the U.S. military too often doing work that should be left to diplomats?
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Fresh Air at 1 o'clock, what went wrong at Arthur Andersen? From Barbara Leigh Toffler, who was a former ethics consultant at that accounting firm. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorian Oriental Rugs, now hosting its annual midwinter event. 6,000 rugs to fit a variety of budgets. Gregorian, a little part of Persia in Newton Lower Falls. And the Boston Conservatory Theater Ensemble performing the musical Rags tomorrow through Saturday. Tickets available at 617-912-9222. And the White Star Tavern, Copley Square, featuring Scott Pelletier's winter menu, awarded Best Affordable Wine List by Boston Magazine 2002. White Star Tavern, 617-536-4477. Join host Robin Young and explore the treasures of ancient Egypt at the Museum of Science exhibit, The Quest for Immortality, on Monday, March 24th. A reception, passes to the Egyptian shows at the Omni or the Planetarium, and more.
A brand new Apple iBook computer could be yours when you make an online contribution for the news. Your $100 contribution today will enter you in a drawing to win a new Apple iBook, courtesy of Tech Superpowers, Back Bay's Apple Service Center. And because every iBook comes with a built-in modem, you can use your new laptop to stay connected to WBUR online wherever you go. Enter the drawing with your contribution of $100 today at WBUR.org. And thanks.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the man accused of murdering an abortion provider says he only meant to stop abortions.
He's showing his hand before he goes to trial.
The hand being
that I shot him and I didn't mean to kill him.
And a child dies every other day in a state's child protection system. We examine why.
One of the things that really has plagued the child welfare system is very low salaries for workers. And with low salaries, very stressful working conditions, the turnover rate becomes very high. Inevitably, you're going to come up with a disaster.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Ted O'Brien. At least 15 people are dead after a suicide bomber ripped through a bus in Israel in the first terrorist attack there in 2 months. It comes as the Israeli army carried on a two-week-old offensive in the Gaza Strip, in which dozens of Palestinians have been killed. No one has claimed a responsibility for the bombing, which both Palestinian and Israeli leaders have condemned. A city in northeastern Colombia has been hit by another bomb attack. At least 7 people were killed, 18 more injured after the explosion in a busy downtown shopping center in the city of Quiquire. Police are blaming rebel groups for that explosion. Diplomats from France, Germany, and Russia say they will block any UN resolution that would authorize war against Iraq. Though it's not clear whether France or Russia, both permanent members of the UN Security Council, would use their veto power. Secretary of State Colin Powell will go to the United Nations Friday to try to convince Security Council members to support the resolution. Powell will join foreign ministers from other nations as they hear the latest report from Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix. An emergency meeting of Islamic leaders in Qatar ended with delegates issuing a final statement welcoming cooperation from Baghdad and strong words against the possibility of war. Mohammed Adami of the Iraqi parliament says the statement by France, Germany, and Russia against war sends a strong message to Washington.
If we count also the demonstrations all over the world, that the whole world officially and publicly is refusing the plans of the American to launch an aggression against Iraq.
Meanwhile, British leader Tony Blair says unless Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix reports that Saddam Hussein is bringing Iraq into compliance with the disarmament agreements, the UN Security Council will vote on a second resolution authorizing war.
To people who say that we are hell-bent on conflict, we still say today it can be avoided if he does what the United Nations and the international community demand that he do.
As he marks Ash Wednesday, the Pope is calling on the world's Catholics to join him in a day of fasting and prayers for peace. The pontiff has been outspoken in his opposition to a possible war with Iraq. A special envoy from the Vatican is preparing to meet with President Bush on that subject at the White House today. Checking the Wall Street numbers, the Dow is up 10 points at 7,714 at this hour. The Nasdaq is off a fraction at 1,307. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Pimsleur Direct Language Programs, featuring over 35 different languages, including American English for speakers of foreign languages, now available at the Public Radio Store at WBUR.org. David L. Babson and Company, investment advisors to private clients and institutions, working to help clients build and preserve wealth since 1940. David L. Babson in Cambridge and on the web at dlbabson.com. And Margulies and Associates, architects and interior designers, using a collaborative process to create innovative solutions for their clients, on the web at margulies.com. This afternoon, we look for the rain to continue and temperatures up into the 40s, the lower 40s. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with lows in the upper 20s and highs in the lower 30s. And on Friday, it'll be sunny, then cloudy and lower 30s once again. Right now, we have light rain in Boston and 41 degrees at 12:35.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
James C. Kopp admits to shooting Dr. Barnett A. Slepian 4 years ago. Kopp says he picked the doctor's name out of a Buffalo phone book, cased out his home, and then shot him with an assault rifle as the doctor heated soup in the kitchen with his wife and one of his 4 children. That part of the story is not up for debate. Kopp's defense of his actions is. James Kopp says he shot Dr. Slepian to prevent him from performing abortions, and he plans to use that reasoning in his upcoming trial. Jury selection began this week in Buffalo, and joining us on the line is Buffalo News reporter Michael Beebe. Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Well, James Kopp's lawyer, also an abortion foe, says that they're going to put abortion itself on trial. What has the judge said about jury opinion, you know, on the procedure as the jury's being selected?
Well, the judge has given the jury or the prospective jurors questionnaires in which he asks them questions about abortions, their personal feelings on abortions. Whether or not this is going to play a role in the trial remains to be seen.
Hasn't the judge said that opinion might not necessarily rule someone out?
Well, he has said that their ability to determine whether or not they can take a fair look at the case and judge him innocent or guilty based on the facts is what will be the determining factor. A person's position on abortion, either for or against, really won't come into play.
Are there some prospective jurors who have said, you know, I can't do this, I have too strong... Yeah. What are they saying?
They're saying, I think the guy is a murderer and I can't hear this case.
Hmm.
Well, in an interview with your newspaper in November, after James Kopp was extradited from France, he had gone on the run after the shooting. He admitted to killing the doctor. Could you explain to us, how is he being tried? Are there state or federal charges or both?
He is charged in both state and federal courts. The state trial is going first. One of the interesting things is the defense lawyers has sort of turned everything on end, because no lawyer ever goes in and allows his client to give an interview. And it's just sort of interesting because he's showing his hand before he goes to trial.
Which, the hand being?
The hand being that I shot him and I didn't mean to kill him. What this allowed the prosecutor to do was, originally they had only charged him with an intentional murder, and the prosecutor immediately went back to a grand jury and got another indictment that added this depraved indifference, saying that, okay, if you didn't mean to intend to kill him, you did something so foolish you killed him anyway.
In that interview, that extraordinary interview in your newspaper, he said, "The truth is not that I regret shooting Dr. Slepian. I regret that he died. He just again wanted to disable him and stop him from performing abortions." Kopp and his lawyers are challenging pro-choice advocates, but it would also seem that they are challenging anti-abortion advocates.
They are, because they feel, as they have said, that if you feel that abortion is murder, then you have to take something other than a protest to stop it. There have been anti-abortion groups in Buffalo who have come out against this feeling, as well as the pro-choice groups.
Hmm. Do you know if any of the prospective jurors are worried about their own safety if they sit on this trial?
Well, we don't know that yet. We have had arguments about cameras in the courtroom, and the judge is going to allow still photography, but the jurors will not be put on camera.
Hmm. Well, Michael, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Buffalo News reporter Michael Beebe speaking to us from Buffalo, New York.
Every other day in the United States, a child dies from abuse or neglect while in a state's child protection system. 153 children a year, according to the latest statistics available for the year 2000. Children like 7-year-old Fahim Williams of New Jersey, who was found dead in his relative's home earlier this year, or 5-year-old Rilia Wilson, who's disappeared and is still missing in the chaos of Florida's foster care system. Child welfare experts are meeting in the nation's capital this week to call attention to the matter. Joining us now on the line from Washington is Shay Bilczik. He's president and CEO of the Child Welfare League of America. Hello, Mr. Bilczik.
Hello, Bill.
Mr. Bilczik, I understand there are some 600,000 children in state child protection care systems. Less than 200, though, died of abuse or neglect in the year 2000. How well are children in foster care or in the child protection care system doing?
Well, clearly, child abuse and neglect is a huge problem within this country. And I have to say that in the vast majority of cases, the state systems that are designed to serve them and the workers in those systems are really doing a very good job. But the problem is that the system does not have the capacity across the board to make sure that every child is protected, that every child is safe, has the kind of permanence in their life that we want, and is either reunited or moved forward in their life to an adoptive family, perhaps.
What most typically goes wrong when a child dies of abuse or neglect within the child protection system?
When things go wrong, what we tend to see is that there are workers who are overwhelmed with their caseloads. They don't have the level of supervision they need. Perhaps they don't have the training they need. One of the things that really has plagued the child welfare system is very low salaries for workers. And with low salaries, very stressful working conditions, the turnover rate becomes very high. Inevitably, you're going to come up with a disaster. You'll never be able to prevent all of them. Even in the best case review possible, you may make a mistake. But when we see so many children who are dying with open cases, when we see overall nationally over 1,200 cases dying of abuse and neglect more broadly, even children, of course, who are not known to the system, we have a serious problem plaguing this society that we need to take in a more serious fashion.
How much of the problem can be rooted in race? In Chicago, 95% of foster children black. In New York City, out of 42,000 children in foster care, only 1,300 are white.
I think it absolutely is overrepresentation of children of color, both in the child welfare system and in the juvenile justice system. And that calls for a really aggressive, proactive attempt at working with those families and children early on. If we're going to count on our child welfare workers, we need to give them the tools to do their job well. That's one of the reasons we're coming together this week, is to share information about what those tools need to be and create a larger voice, a stronger voice, to get the investment at both the federal and state level.
Mr. Bilczyk, briefly, tell me how much money you would need ideally to fight this problem next year and how much money you expect to have.
I think an added investment of $10 billion. If that investment was made by the federal government and then was matched by state government, we'd see a huge sea change in how well these kids were protected and served by the system that really is charged with serving them by law. And too many of them are living this kind of life frozen in time where they don't have the stability, the positive adult present in their life. Their life is in transition for far too long when they go into the Child Protective Service system. That is a crisis in my mind.
Shay Bilczyk, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, Bill.
Shay Bilczyk is president and CEO of the Child Welfare League of America.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. There are now a number of people who prefer to find their sacred space in cyberspace. If you go online, you'll find spiritual guidance for every need, from emailed prayer requests to readable sermons. And then there's the First Church of Cyberspace. It has no chapel, no clergy, no choir. But as you enter the online sanctuary, you can click on A Mighty Fortress is Our God. Reverend Charles Henderson is the church founder. He's on the line from New York. Hello, Reverend.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm fine. I understand that you actually are also in a building that's called the God's Box.
The God Box, yes.
The God Box.
It's on Riverside Drive, right across from Union Theological Seminary and Columbia University.
And next to Riverside Church.
Right.
You are a real reverend?
I'm an actual reverend in real time, not just in cyberspace. I'm a Presbyterian minister, but I'm actually working as the publisher of Cross Currents magazine right now.
Well, but is the First Church of Cyberspace a real church? It has no elders, no deacons. Is it?
It's real. It's real in the sense that a community can be real, mediated through the internet.
But what about the congregation aspect? You know, the community that a church affords. Baptisms, for instance, the hands-on.
Right.
The time in a service where you turn and greet your neighbor, you know. What about that aspect of church?
That is not fully realized on the internet right now, but there is a surprising amount of community and personal relationships that develop in chat rooms and in forums.
In fact, you have several forums where some of the conversations that are running right now, Lord of the Rings, is it a
right.
Christian classic?
Right.
Is Satan responsible for evolution?
Right.
Do alcohol and religion mix?
Right. Yes, they do, obviously. One of Christ's first miracle was to turn the water into wine.
Right.
So these are clearly mixed.
These are the kinds of discussions that are being held. What about, Reverend, people who are desperate, who desperately need
in
counseling?
The chat room that I run and that is active every night, where people have been coming in some cases every night for 5 years, we've gone through experiences of death, birth, marriage, and all the other transitions of life, where the people who you've met in the chat room can provide support and friendship to you in a time of need. So that aspect of human relationships that takes place online is exactly the same as it would be in a real church.
Mm. And do you really think, I mean, would you recommend that people, you know, click on rather than come in?
No, I wouldn't. I would say that it's, for many people, it's a supplement to their involvement in the real church. But others have been so alienated from real churches for various reasons, like the sexual abuse scandal is just one of them, that they aren't ready to or haven't felt called to participate in churches.
It is a Christian church.
Yep.
Are Episcopalians and, you know, Methodists, Baptists going to be able to sit together in the virtual pews?
One of the surprising things that happens is that I'd say at least half of the people that participate are not Christians. And they come in wishing to be confronted with difference of opinion. And that's what draws people to it, to the diversity and the difference and the freedom to express your ideas, even if they don't fit into the box that people would recognize as being the Christian box.
Well, Reverend, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Reverend Charles Henderson is the founder of the First Church of Cyberspace. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Fresh Air at 1 o'clock, a look at what happened with Enron, and specifically the Arthur Andersen Accounting Company, from a woman who's written a book about that. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Ned Newman, a solutions integration firm working with financial services and pharmaceutical companies to meet business goals through technology in New York and Boston, and at nednewman.com. And Newton Wellesley Hospital, in collaboration with Brigham and Women's and Massachusetts General Hospitals, 866-NWH-DOCS, and on the web at nwh.org, as well as the Elliott Hotel, winner of Travel and Leisure's Best Hotels in the World for 2003, and home to Clio Restaurant and the Uni, the sashimi bar at Clio. Information at ElliottHotel.com. Meet Scott Simon. Learn more about our next Citizens of the World tour to Africa, Thursday, March 13th. 800-909-9287.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now, and it's Wednesday, so Bill and I have moved into the kitchen, ladles in hand. They're kind of the divining rods that have found a big pot of soup.
You found me.
In the kitchen.
That's why you were asking me what a divining rod was.
Along with resident chef Kathy Gunst. She's the mastermind behind the soup, and as usual, we love visiting with you on Wednesday for what could be dinner tonight on many tables. Hi, Kath.
Hi, good to be here.
What do you got?
I've got something. I tell you, I have been sick as a dog. I've been in bed the past three days. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice. So it seemed like it was a really good day for soup because it's raining here in Boston. And unfortunately, we can't really say that winter's over. But I have sprung forward a bit because what we've got is a chicken soup that we're going to add all these fabulous ingredients, garlic, saffron, lemon, and then I've roasted some spring vegetables, asparagus and onions and portobello mushrooms. And what's really great about this soup is that it layers and textures all kinds of flavors. This is a soup. I got this recipe from Chef Laura Brennan, who owns a fabulous restaurant in the south end of Boston called Cafe Umbra. Mm. She is the queen of soups. She made this soup for me, and I almost died and went to heaven.
Well, thank goodness she didn't.
Yeah.
You're here now.
That's good point. Good. I'm here and now. Okay,
how
enough
do we start?
Of that. We start with a chicken broth. I made a homemade chicken broth. You don't have to do that. Get a good low-sodium chicken broth. I've heated it up here. What I'm going to do is chop up a stalk of celery to begin with.
By the way, if somebody is, you know, wants to make the broth, you just put the bones of a chicken in.
I put a whole chicken in, a few stalks of celery, onion, carrot. Let it simmer for about an hour and a half until the chicken's just about falling off the bone. Season it with salt and pepper and a bay leaf. It's called Jewish penicillin, and there's a reason for it. It works. And then just strain it out. You can see this is a very beautiful color. This is real chicken broth. But I made it earlier today with canned chicken broth, and you know what? It wasn't bad at all. So I'm adding two stalks of celery. Now, you'll see there's something red. This is saffron, the world's most expensive spice. You do not need to use this, but it adds an earthy, kind of deep, wonderful texture.
You're just putting just a tiny sprinkle.
Tiny bit, and I'm just crumpling it.
You know, I went and bought this once years ago.
Saffron.
Before it was more popular. I felt as if I was buying something illicit.
Yes, of course you did.
I had to go to the back of a place where somebody slipped me an
hey,
envelope.
Hey, lady, give me your saffron.
But now you can get saffron, fresh saffron, pretty much anywhere.
In the grocery store, exactly. What I've also put in here is a cup of orzo. Now, traditionally, you have pasta with a little bit of broth. This is a lot of broth with a little bit of pasta. This is something Laura Brennan taught me also. You just add a little pasta. It enriches the soup. It thickens a little. It adds a great texture. I love orzo. You can use any type of little pasta.
So tell us about orzo just for a second, because
orzo is used a lot by the Greeks. A lot of people, it's the shape of rice. A lot of people think it is rice, but it's an actual wheat pasta, and it's got a really great chewiness to it. Mm. I love it. It's a real quick fix thing for comfort food, just boiled orzo drained with just a little butter.
Now,
and
it's
Parmesan
soup easy to make. Earlier you were saying, we're going to take about 10 minutes in this segment, but you said you could make this in about 2 minutes.
Well, because I'm organized, Bill. Yes. In reality,
there
if you had...
There seems to be a lot of things around.
The stock is
you're
the backbone
together.
Of your soup. Uh-huh. The better your stock, the better your soup. And if you make a homemade stock, it's going to be fabulous. If you use a regular one, you're going to add... So I'm also going to add a clove, very thinly sliced garlic. You see, I haven't crushed it. I've just added it thinly sliced. So we've got about 6 cups of chicken broth, 2 celery stalks that are thinly sliced, a pinch of saffron, which you don't need, salt and pepper, and about a cup of orzo. Now, in this pan, I want you to understand, this is like a big generic recipe. You can do anything you want here. I have the portobello mushrooms and asparagus cut into about 1.5 inch pieces and some onions. These colors and flavors and textures are going to layer our soup. But there's one more part of this. And the answer is yes, it's easy. 2 eggs.
We're over at a bowl now. So
yep, we're over at a bowl. We're going to whisk the eggs. Okay, lightly whisk it. We're going to add the juice of a lemon. You can find my favorite Meyer lemons, which I've become addicted to this winter.
What's different about them?
Oh, they taste like orange and lemon. And smell this. It smells like an orange orchard.
Yeah.
It's not nearly as acidic. Oh, wow. They're hard to find. It's the end of the season.
What are they called?
Meyer lemons. M-E-Y-E-R, named for a scientist named Mr. Meyer. About 2 to 3 tablespoons of grated Parmesan cheese. So we've got 2 eggs and our grated cheese and our lemon. What we're going to do is add this to the soup. But if I added it right now, it would crumble and it would turn into like an egg drop soup.
Yeah.
So what we're going to do is something called tempering. We're going to take a ladleful of our hot broth and we're going to add it to the eggs. And what it's going to do essentially is get the eggs used to the hotter temperature so that when they go in, they don't curdle and separate. Stand back, my dear.
It's kind of an insider's trick there.
That is. It's called tempering, and it sounds very fancy, but it's... Okay, and I'm whisking it in, and now what's happening is the chicken broth is going to start to thicken. It turns this gorgeous lemon yellow, and all the saffron and celery is in there, the orzo and the garlic, and you just watch what happens there. Isn't that gorgeous?
Spring-like colors in the dead of winter.
Well, there. That's a nice, hopeful tone. I like that. Okay, so we're going to let that cook for a minute. Let's check our veggies. The roasted, you can roast these or you can saute them. You don't want them to be soft. You just want them to have a good, you know, you don't want them too crunchy. But really, you could use spinach. We're going to add a little arugula at the end of this. You could use red pepper, green pepper, any seasonal vegetable.
So you didn't do anything to this asparagus. It's a beautiful bright green right now. By the way, we'll, of course, have everything on the website for you. But it's a beautiful bright green. You didn't steam those or do anything. You just put them right in the pan.
I put them right in. I put them in a 400-degree oven for about 25 minutes and let them soften. I'm just finishing them off on top of the oven here because we love that sound. And it's very pretty, and they didn't cook quite long enough. And it was getting too hot in here, to tell you the truth. Okay, that's it. The soup is done. So what we're going to do, I mean, talk about layering and texturing. We're going to ladle the soup into a big soup bowl here, and then the pasta will be on the bottom. You'll see the pasta's not the most important part.
It sinks.
Excuse me.
Oh, there's that cold. So
I
need
my soup.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Notice how it's thickened there? So people often wonder, do you have to add cream to a soup? No. An egg can do the trick. The bit of Parmesan cheese in there. So we're going to ladle this into our bowl. And then we're going to just add the roasted vegetables on top. So we're layering colors and textures. I'm very sorry.
Eat this woman.
Kathy needs this soup, huh? I'm telling you, this stuff works. So you can see, it's so beautiful because the orzo's in there and thickens it. The celery will not be soft. You want the crunch. You're adding good texture there.
Kind of a deep butterscotch yellow with that lovely lime celery there.
Isn't that nice? Yeah. And then those little bits. Instead of saffron, you could use chopped tomatoes. Get your spoons ready, ladies and gents. Okay, so you ladle your broth in. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a good assortment of mushrooms, and I'm going to just put them in the middle here. So we're layering bright green asparagus with the rich brown portobello mushroom and the onions right on top of this very yellow thickened broth.
It's like a mountain coming out of the middle.
Give that a try.
Now, the arugula is a pretty
green leaf. Oh, I'm sorry.
Leaf.
I forgot the arugula.
That's
we're
right.
going to just sprinkle a few. Yes. You can excuse me for everything.
Working its way
we just
your...
want it to wilt. We're just going to sprinkle a little bit on the side. It's almost
That's
like
pretty.
A garnish, but the heat of the soup will heat it up and it will wilt. Attack it.
This
Go
is
for
so
it.
Pretty.
Kathy, this is a main course soup also, you should realize. This is really a hearty, and it
hot.
Could be a vegetarian broth if you want it. Very hot?
It's hot, but it's absolutely delicious.
I'm sorry.
Oh, give her here.
Just thick enough.
Just take me to the hospital. I'll be fine. Don't worry about me.
Well, I tell you where you can find out about this, because we always have everything on the website. And by the way, I want to mention, last week I made your warm winter salad.
You did.
And if visitors to the website got that recipe before the correction was made, at one point it said to use the
watercress.
But remove the leaves.
Yes,
of course,
that's not really
if you
a very good
the leaves,
trick.
No, you would just have like these stems in your salad.
Watercress is a little expensive. For
but
that.
It was delicious. So check out all of Kathy's recipes at the website. And now we'll add to that the lemon and pasta soup. Kathy, thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Thanks, Kathy.
And
lovely,
I hope everybody
creamy
feels
taste
well. Isn't that nice?
Mm.
Don't forget, go to our website at here-now.org and somebody get Kathy some soup.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at MathWorks.com. At MathWorks.com.